good looking. You're hot.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Troy?
Now that is between us, okay?
But you were...
In a coma? Nothing like having your face cut off to disturb your sleep. Read the newspaper lately?
Episode 26 of the Cut Print Film Podcast is all about Brian De Palma's lovely film Blowout. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 26. My name is Chris Evangelista.
I'm Jeff Rollins.
Look, all right, so this guy...
Who are you?
Say your name.
Or anything.
What are you saying? I'm Dave. Star Wars? What are you about to say? No,
Dave who?
Dave Costel.
All right. I just wanted to make sure.
I just want
to
say...
Could be any Dave in the basement. Dave Thomas from Strange Brew.
Or at Wendy's.
One of those Dave Thomases.
Am I going to get my grape out?
I hope so.
Get it
this
out.
This is not a grape.
All right. Oh. Lay it on me.
So if you left a one-star review for us, I have research and I am educated on what we're about to talk about.
All right.
We got a one-star review on iTunes saying we were too, I guess, jovial. We're too
We're having too much fun.
Yeah. More or less this reviewer said, "I don't like shows where people enjoy themselves. I want stuffy, stodgy nonsense."
Yeah, and we're not all about that at all. In fact, I'll have you know that this show is filmed in Costal Vision. And then the video is removed and thrown in the garbage, and we just have the raw audio. And that's how the magic is made.
Yeah, that's it. So, I mean,
it's all in the
we put the video
vision.
Up on Vimeo.
So, and then we delete it.
We're a podcast about movies, and I think we take movies seriously, but not to the point where it's boring. I mean, I take movies seriously, but I want to have fun, and I don't want to, like, bore people.
Yeah, I think we're very serious about movies.
We're just...
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're just three regular guys calling it as it is.
Yeah. Well, no, that we're not.
Don't say it like that, because
then you're somebody's grandmother. I tell it like it is. Well, maybe you should just go out to pasture then.
Get on that ice and float out to sea like an Eskimo.
Like an Inuit.
Today we'll be discussing 1981's Blowout.
That was weird.
I don't know.
Is this me being a film guy.
Oh, I thought it was
my new character.
Is film guy a Muppet or something?
He's the crypt keeper.
The crypt keeper.
Hey, what are we talking about today?
Boils and ghouls.
Hello, kitties.
Oh, what, did you address all the boils and ghouls?
Yeah.
No, he did that.
Oh,
all right. So, if you're just tuning in now, if you somehow missed that crazy introduction, this is the second episode in our director series.
Wait, hold on. Let me hit this.
Director series.
We're directing.
And we're directing movies.
See? We're very serious
perfect,
about movies.
Perfect.
We're even serenading them.
So.
All right, either we're doing really bad or it's hot in here because I'm sweating.
Well, Dave is wearing a sweater and it's August. I don't know what the. I showed up for the podcast tonight and I saw Dave had a sweater on and I wanted to say, come on.
Hold on.
What are you doing?
Take right. my sweater off.
Now the whole shirt's off.
Yeah. We just saw Dave's abs as steel. Great cheese on those abs.
This episode is out of control. I'll have you both know.
Maybe that one-star review guy was on to something. All right. All right, let's take it back a notch. All right, so the director series is we pick a director, and then we watch three of that director's films, and then we talk about it on the podcast.
Last week, what did we watch?
We watched Sisters, because this... Our first director in the director series is Brian De Palma. So we watched his film Sisters for last week.
From 1973.
Yes.
Coming at you.
That was a good year, as someone at the supermarket would say.
10 years before I was born, so it means nothing to me.
Oh, yeah, fuck that year. And this year, I'm drunk. This episode, we're talking about 1981's Blowout.
Yes.
Okay.
Starring John Travolta.
Yes.
As Blowout Jones, a pitcher who hasn't lost a game.
I'm going to say this right now. If you haven't seen Blowout, go watch it.
Yeah, we're going to be spoiling
it. What is wrong
it.
With you? I just watched it for the first time last night, and I already feel superior to you.
Yeah, I watched it.
Not seen it.
I watched it earlier this week for the first time as well, and boy, oh boy, I can't believe this one slipped by me.
I was the one member of the podcast who has seen this movie, so I'm better than everyone.
That's right.
I would say this is probably, I would hail this as Brian De Palma's best film, in my opinion. I don't know.
I don't want to get crazy.
Calm down there.
If that didn't sell you on Blowout, just keep listening, and you know, you'll hear all about it, but it might pique your interest to the point where you're like, I'm going to watch this fucking thing, even though I already know what happens because these three idiots ruined it for me.
So yeah, watch Blowout before you listen to the rest of the show, because we're going to be spoiling it like eggs. So Blowout stars John Travolta,
right,
Nancy Allen, John Lithgow, and Dennis Franz,
yes,
of NYPD Blue fame. Remember when he showed his hiney crack?
Well, he never puts a shirt on in this film. He's always in a tank top.
Sipowitz?
Yeah. Yes.
This is actually the pre-pilot to Third Rock from the Sun.
I
don't think that's true.
I mean, I'm looking at it from a whole new light now that you've said that.
They're from Mars, all of them.
Oh, all right.
No, they're actually not. They're from Philadelphia.
Right. Yeah, that was fun. That
Philadelphia.
This film was filmed in Philly, and that was neat. But you want to run down the plot?
Right. All right. So,
okay, we got to come back to Philly, though.
We will. We're
going to touch on every aspect of this film, even the key grip.
Yeah. Well, especially the key grip.
Yeah, and the gaffer.
I hear he can break walnuts with his biceps.
In Blowout, movie sound technician Jack Terry, played by John Travolta, gets involved in a mysterious and deadly conspiracy.
Mm.
While trying to record new sounds for a low-budget horror film he's working on, Terry inadvertently records a car accident that kills a presidential candidate and nearly drowns a woman in the car with him.
Yeah.
Wait, I want to start at the beginning.
Before
you
want to
begin at the beginning?
Okay.
Before the plot kicks in?
There was a firmament, and then God spoke. And then there was light.
Listen. Oh, you're going back way too far.
Listen, well, did you want to go back to the MGM lion roaring?
Okay.
Do you want to go back to the Criterion logo that was on my copy?
So the first 5 minutes of the film,
yeah.
Again, we get...
Fake out.
We get a fake out in the vein of Sisters and a Peeping Tom-related fake out.
Uh-huh.
And the word Peeping Tom is said about 20 times in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I would say, like, this film, it's like... Everything that Brian De Palma learned from his other movies, he put into this movie and made it better.
Yeah.
There are parts of this beginning that feel like it's De Palma making fun of
absolutely. De Palma. It's De Palma making fun of his own image.
Which is genius.
Of making, like, exploitative, like, movies.
It also makes him more approachable.
Right.
So that you know that this is a guy who has got his tongue slightly in his cheek a little bit. He's very cheeky, if you will.
Yeah, he's a cheeky devil.
But
Does anyone want to explain this to the audience, what happens in the opening scene?
Well, yeah, the film opens with a first-person perspective.
Right, point of view shot.
Sort of like Michael Myers.
Right.
And you see that...
Oh, behave. Do I make you horny, babe?
That's Mike Myers.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On set, they actually referred to this as the Halloween scene.
Okay,
so it's a direct parody of.
So yeah, you see, it's a first person perspective. And
also, it's entirely shot in Steadicam, and this was the first time Brian De Palma had ever used Steadicam.
Oh, nice.
I learned that from the DVD.
You can see the knife in the top corner of the frame. So that you can tell this guy's holding a knife, and
it's product placement though, because it's Mustaf, and they want to sell it to you.
So he's stalking this. I guess it's a sorority house.
Right,
and he's peeping in through all the windows,
and pretty much in every window, it gets more
There's
and more
debauchery.
Yeah,
going
the more
on.
And more debauched, the more you look.
There's there's a girl studying, and then he's like, "Fuck this."
Yeah, goes to boring. The next one is like girls dancing
with
in their lingerie.
Yes.
And they have a disco ball in their dorm room somehow.
Because it's 1981.
Yes.
And then you see the one girl complain. Or no, wait. Doesn't he walk up and stab to death another Peeping Tom?
He stabs to death a cop.
There's a cop.
There's a cop on campus looking in the window.
He kills him.
He stabs the cop, and the cop makes a sound that goes like that. And then he dies.
And then he somehow gets in the building into the female shower.
Right. Well, first area. He sees a girl masturbating. It's
oh, yes, I forgot.
Every room, it's more and more sexually explicit, which is it just adds to the humor of the scene.
Until you get to the full nudity in the shower, and he comes upon a girl in the shower, and he kills her. But well, no, he goes to kill her, but she lets out this horrific,
the best slash worst scream
ever. It's pretty terrible, and it sounds like this.
It's so good, and it just an instant laugh, and it instantly jars you because you're going like, into this film unprepared, you don't know what kind of movie you're
and
seeing.
So then it pulls back to the director of the film and
Travolta,
who's the sound guy,
sound
on the
technician,
film.
And they're working on cutting in screams and effects, and you're like, oh, I was totally fooled. Were you fooled?
I was like,
because I didn't read the synopsis at all. I went into this blind because
I was like, that was my first thought because it's very, it's like done.
It's intentionally bad because it's supposed to look like a bad horror movie.
And one of the first things I said, I was like, the sound is really bad on this.
Yeah, I have that in my notes. You are bombarded with sound right off the bat.
It's intentionally bad.
Why is everything so loud?
Which is an interesting point I want to come back to later. Okay. But, and then it breaks down to Travolta and the director arguing because the director is accusing Travolta of having screamed the scream, which I'm still not sure if they come to a conclusion on whether he did or not. But sounds like he did.
And he's also pissed off because Travolta just keeps reusing library music, which is just like stock music, basically. Okay. And the director says, like, I've heard that wind a million times before.
Right.
And Travolta's like, what do you want me to do about it? And the director says, go out and record some new wind.
And that is where the movie actually starts. Right. The plot kicks in with what Chris just said. Travolta goes out and he's recording sounds, and what happens?
So
wait, I got so much more on the opening scene. We gotta go back.
We're gonna plow forward. Chris, what happens?
So Travolta's on the bridge. He's on a bridge recording sound, and this is a great it's filmed perfectly. So De Palma does this thing where he's trying to basically cut from Travolta's perspective because he has to show everything that's going around him. So there's like three quick cuts where the camera pans back once, twice, and a third time.
Was that like shocking? Yeah.
And it reveals just a wide shot of everything around Travolta, and like he's picking up sounds with his it's like a shotgun mic, it's like a boom mic stick.
Yeah, it looks like spy tech from the early 90s. It's filmed
almost as an homage to The Conversation because
there's a lot in this movie that is like The Conversation, but it's like
I have that written in my notes. Yeah. This is like The Conversation with him with that mic sticking out on the bridge, and he's just pointing at things, and he has the headphones on. I was like, wow.
And for those who don't know, The Conversation is the Francis Ford Coppola film with Gene Hackman. It's an excellent movie.
Fantastic movie.
So Travolta's, he's out, he's recording sounds. He picks up, like, there's two people on a bridge making out, and they're like, there's some guy spying on us. And then he picks up, like, the sound of a frog.
Ribbit, ribbit.
Yeah, there's a frog, there's an owl.
Hoot, hoot. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
There's a bat.
It's just like a... Yeah. Yeah.
Where's the drugs?
There's a fishmonger. Fresh fish!
A fishmonger!
None of these two things. All right, so there is an owl. There is a frog. He's just picking up sounds. But then he hears a car barreling down the road.
A TIE fighter goes by.
What? Wow, none of that happens.
All right, but the car thing does happen. Yes. So there's a loud bang sound, and the car basically goes over a bridge into a river, which calls the real-life incident of Teddy Kennedy driving his car into Martha's Vineyard with the Chappaquiddick incident, which is deliberate. Again, it's for those who don't know, I forget when it happened, but Teddy Kennedy drove his car into
1969
into Chappaquiddick into basically the bay.
Yeah, with a female passenger,
and he left her in the car, and then walked. He walked home and went to bed.
And for anyone playing at home, Teddy Kennedy lived many, many more years than that girl did.
And he did a lot of good political things, but he also drowned a woman.
Yes, he did. And got away with it.
It was also a year after they blew a hole in his second brother's head.
Yeah. So I guess everyone was like, let's take it easy on Teddy Kennedy. So anyway, so Travolta, he says, Jesus Christ, and he runs, he jumps in the river, Meanwhile, you see a guy up on the bridge who's been watching this whole thing run away.
Yeah.
So Travolta, he jumps in the river. He's trying to get to the car. He gets to the car. It's clear the guy in the car is dead.
Yes.
But there's a woman in the car with the guy, and she's still alive. So Travolta breaks the windshield. He gets her out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to, they're at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the film, we see a news footage of there's a senator who's a presidential candidate, and there's a poll showing if the election
this
was
guy
held,
will win.
He 62% of the vote.
That's it's done in a split screen,
right?
The first of many in this film,
right? And it's,
which is a thing,
a De Palma signature.
It's a Hitchcock signature that De Palma loves using. But
I think at this point, it's like.
It's De Palma,
De Palma signature.
That's what I was just going to say.
It's such a, again, touching back on how this is like every De Palma thing done better. Like, when you compare the split screen in this film to the split screen in Sisters, it's so much better.
Yeah.
Because first of all, everything's in focus, which is great. Because in Sisters, it's a little hazy and blurry. So,
and not to knock Sisters. I did like the split screen effect in that, but this is just cleaner.
Yeah.
De Palma does amazing things with split screen in this film. There's actually scenes where he does a split screen.
And you don't really know that.
Like using the set itself.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but there's a scene where Lithgow pulls the ice pick out of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
They're like... The fish is on one side, and her walking is in the right hand of the frame, and it's a perfect split screen.
Yeah, and it looks like it's actually
like shot
walking at him.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I'll see if I can bring up a picture of that, but we'll keep moving.
I know what you're talking about. So at the hospital, Travolta learns that
he gets awesome green pants.
Yeah, he gets some sweet green pants.
Cruising around in those scrubs.
He's smoking a cigarette in the hospital because you could do that back then.
And he's got his hair slicked back and a wee bit of a mullet going on.
He looks fucking cool in this movie.
Yeah, he does.
I don't know what it is, but
I'll agree with that.
Something about him in this movie is just
that's what
really
I'm saying.
Cool.
Like him in the hospital, like he's wearing those scrubs. He looked cool, and
he looks sort of like Fonzie.
He got his fucking feet up. He's like, "What do you want me to say? She fell in the river. I fucking saved her."
The cop interrogating him is trying to get him to, you know, perjure himself.
Right.
He's like, "Oh, just objectively." Interviewing a witness.
Yeah, and he's like, what are we doing here? Travolta, the witness, is like, what are you trying to do?
He does what I wouldn't have done.
Right.
I would have been like, I killed her. I'm sorry.
Admitting something you didn't do. I'm the murderer. What are you talking
like
about?
Damien Eccles. I just go away forever.
All right, so Travolta's like, what the hell is going on? And it becomes clear that the man in the car was this future president, basically.
Yeah.
And so everyone's trying to cover up the fact that this guy was in the car with another woman. He's got a family. And Travolta's hesitant at first, but he's like, all right, fine. I'll agree to this.
I thought that was nice that Travolta questioned the ethics.
Right, he has integrity,
basically. Of lying to the press, or actually of just keeping silent about the fact that there was a woman in the car. Just never let that fact slip out to the press.
It's a character moment, and it's while, like, it's slightly annoying, as like, watching it. You're like, just fucking keep your mouth shut.
Yeah,
who cares?
I agree, because, like, if that were me, I'd be like, all right.
Yeah.
Because I have no fucking integrity.
Yeah. Here at Cut Print Film, zero integrity to be found.
If a cop or if someone was like, will you lie? I'd be like, all right. It wouldn't take me. I wouldn't even hesitate.
I didn't even offer you any money. Wow.
Yeah. I'd be like, fine. I guess I'll lie. Whatever. Can I go home?
Then he wandered, or did we already discuss him wandering into the chick's room?
No, we didn't.
Room.
So he wanders into, and the girl, her name is Sally. She's playing Nancy Allen, who is adorable in this movie.
Really? I have written down Nancy Allen is an obnoxious child.
No, I think...
I hate her in this.
I think she is adorable in this. Nancy Allen is probably best known for playing RoboCop's partner in RoboCop.
Yep.
And she was also married to Brian De Palma when this film was made.
Yeah, that explains a whole lot.
And she was in the movie of his before this, Dress to Kill, which is also great, but a lot sleazier than this movie. And she's sort of like an airhead, and like I could
sort of
all right. Like an airhead. I could see why you would be annoyed by her performance, but I kind of found that endearing that she's sort of like childlike and goofy
not work for me at all. The entire I just didn't like her.
It works for me because she's so innocent. It makes what happens to her at the end a lot more upsetting. I think that's why it works.
There's a point in the film where you think maybe
that's a good point. Thanks,
Jeff.
Maybe it was an act when she goes to Sipowitz's place, and I was like, all right, that makes sense.
Sipowitz. That's he's always playing Sipowitz.
And I was like, okay, she's acting dumb. This makes sense. And it's like, no, she's just dumb.
Yeah, she's a dumb
and
bell.
And she's that is fucking that perm is killing me, man.
Well, I
that's
forgive
just the hair back then.
I can let hairstyles
hair,
and
hair in the hair in the '80s was the worst.
Yes. Also, shoulder pads in the '80s not good yeah. either.
The '80s was bad in general. Ronald Reagan, no thanks.
I was just like, how do people like it? Just look like old pictures of my mom. I'm like, I can't get into this character, but she's. Not a great actress.
That's my problem.
I don't think she's a bad actress. I think she's... Because if you watch her performance in this and compare it to, like, Dressed to Kill or even RoboCop, it's a much different performance. So she's not really an idiot, guys.
I'm well aware.
She's just playing one in a movie.
I don't think she plays an idiot very well.
Okay.
Because she seemed almost as though she had a mental handicap. Like, she seemed handicapped.
Yeah, at certain points. And, like, there's...
I won't disagree. I personally like the performance, but
let's
she flubs a couple
Nancy
lines too.
Let's not beat up Nancy Allen anymore. Yeah. So,
all right, let's keep. Okay.
And she's a woman.
And you know how we feel about women. We love them.
All right, so basically, the character is a ditz.
Yeah.
So, but she's also in this initial scene. She's really drugged up, which makes her 10 times more ditzier than she is in the movie. So,
That scene was filmed awesome.
Yeah,
like
it was.
The look of it looked kind of like 2001-y. Like there's these awesome shots of like their up angles at Travolta standing next to the bed, and it just like it made the room look so wide and massive. But they're in like a thing that's what would you say, curtained off?
Yeah,
like a square. It's a very small space, but it just felt. Huge and white and
before we move on, I wanted to make a point about the camera. It's always grounded. The camera is always at ground level, or like even like you said, Dave, it's kind of shooting up sometimes.
Yeah.
It's never looking down.
There is one scene looking down.
Is there? I missed that.
It's
then.
Where Nancy Allen breaks the bottle of J&B over Sipowitz's head when he's on the bed,
casually raping her.
But for the most part, for the majority of the film, the camera is at.
You're correct.
Eye level.
Right.
Practically.
And the camera work in this is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
And
all right.
The set, just like the lighting and the coloring, there's a lot of like bright, garish red.
Mm. It starts out red.
Right. And it just, but it works. It just, it perfectly encapsulates just the tone of the film. So
I read somewhere that someone seriously was suggesting that this is the end of De Palma's red phase. And that's why red... and blue are so prominent in the film because his films start to take on a blue tone after this.
See, I found Sisters to have a blue color tone.
I would say it's like blue bordering on white, I would say.
Yeah, well, I read that and I didn't make that up, so I'm not taking credit for it.
So
good, because it's a BS theory, I say.
I can see the red in Sisters, the fucking blood that's squirting out of him.
Yeah, but that's blood.
It's overly bloody, though.
He wasn't a blue blood rich aristocrat. So,
there's a lot of red and blue in this film, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
It takes place during something called Liberty Day.
Which is not real. They basically made up a ceremony in Philadelphia called Liberty Day.
We're from Philly.
Yeah.
We know better.
It's not real.
De Palma grew up in Philly.
He did.
And he said that this is the first film where he knew the sets more intimately than.
Oh,
like,
nice.
Because, like. He grew up in all these places, much like we did. Like,
yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia. I don't know if you guys did.
Well, we grew up going there. You know what I mean?
Like, I
actually grew up in Philadelphia.
The mean streets.
Yeah, the mean streets of Port Richmond. And I don't know about you guys, but whenever I see a movie that has like a lot of Philadelphia in it, I get like, I won't say nostalgic, but
like
I get,
World War Z?
Yeah, no thanks. They filmed the Philadelphia scenes in that in Prague. So... whenever I see films that actually shoot in Philadelphia, I get sort of like I know where that is. It's like
fun.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you go to a concert and someone's like, "Hello, Philadelphia," and everyone's like, "That's I know where that is."
That's us. He's talking about us.
It's stupid, but it's like brand recognition. Like and like every exterior shot, I knew exactly where it was in this movie, And that's sort of like exciting. It makes it realistic because you can relate to that.
Yeah, I have written in my notes, I just want a Termini Brothers cannoli.
Yeah.
I got really hungry.
Like, there's a scene where John Lithgow is stalking Nancy Allen through, like, the Reading Terminal Market. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I want to go to the Reading Terminal Market right now and get a million things that are bad for me and eat them.
A Taroni. Delicious Italian snack.
There's a scene in a gallery. There's a scene.
Yeah.
There's a huge scene at 30th Street Station. Right. But I would say that this, go out on a limb, I think, maybe, and say that this is the best Philadelphia movie.
Yeah, there's more Philadelphia.
It's one of them.
There's more Philadelphia in this movie than there is in Rocky. Which I think, Rocky can suck it compared to this. Everyone like thinks of Rocky as like the quintessential Philadelphia movie. And I mean, they do, because in Philadelphia. Yeah.
But this fucking movie is way more Philly. I mean, there should be a fucking statue of John Travolta sitting on that bench.
There should be a statue of John Travolta holding his mic out, holding his ears in horror.
I want him sadly sitting at Penn's Landing on that bench at the end of the film.
There's literally a scene in this film where John Travolta drives his car through City Hall.
Oh, I can't wait.
Which I've wanted
to
do a million times, by the way.
I can't wait till we get to that.
All right, so we're jumping ahead. So. John Travolta and Nancy Allen's character, they leave the hospital because everyone's trying to hush up that they witnessed the crime. And later in the film, a character says, "You're an ear witness to the crime," which is a fucking fantastic line.
I love that line. You're an ear witness.
Right. So.
It's Detective Mackey says that.
Is that his name? Okay. So.
The fucking most asshole cop in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason he hates Travolta, and we'll get to that later. So. Travolta is convinced that there's more to this crime than meets the eye.
The ear.
Yes. He's convinced that...
Or the nose.
Nope. You messed it all up.
This film is filmed in smell-o-vision. So, since Travolta recorded the whole thing, he listens to it on his reel-to-reel.
Yeah.
And he hears a bang sound that clearly is a gunshot. And he's
that was it.
And he's convinced it's a gunshot. So he's convinced someone shot out that tire. So he keeps trying to basically prove that this happened.
It's cool because at this point, the film kind of turns into a movie about making movies.
Yeah.
Which is what I loved about it.
I have written down, it's a love letter to sound editing in movies.
Not only sound editing, because there's film editing at a certain point, too, when he starts putting the...
Did you have to make me look bad like that?
God, Dave.
I'm sorry.
Jeff's wrong.
No. Like,
you know what I mean?
I totally agree.
It turns into like, is this De Palma like trying to see it from his point of view? Because there's a strong argument at the end. Like,
oh, I can't wait to watch
it. It is. And it's also, again, going back to real life events, it's also like, it's like an homage to the Zapruder film, basically.
Yeah,
they even say that in the film, but it's.
This is an homage to the Zapruder film.
So this film
is my Travolta.
Perfect line reading.
The three big things, the three big real world adventures. That was a stupid thing.
Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Da-da.
The three real world things this film touches on the most, I would say, are Chappaquiddick with the
Vietnam.
No,
I just made that
Chappaquiddick,
up.
Chappaquiddick, the Zapruder film, and Watergate.
Yeah.
Watergate, it's just with the fact of just recording people. And and De Palma, actually, he wrote the script for this in the 70s, and it didn't get made to the 80s. So it has those sort of like 70s holdovers from the 60s.
Oh, this whole film is a holdover from the 70s.
Right.
It's only 1981.
This is a 70s film.
Pretty much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would say most films that take place that are even filmed in the 80s until like 1984, they're still 70s movies. And then, like, around 85, it became the quote-unquote 80s.
Yeah, you got your new wave coming in.
Right. So, where were we?
Let's dance!
All right, where are we?
All right, so...
We're approximately 7 minutes into the movie.
The plot gets kind of wacky and convoluted at this point, because it turns out a hitman has been hired by the opposing candidate to make this dude, McRyan, look bad. But the problem is you don't hire a psychopath like John Lithgow just to make somebody
look
bad.
John Lithgow plays the Philly Strangler.
His name is Burke. He is so good in this movie. He doesn't have a lot of scenes.
He's awesome.
But like the few scenes he's in, he's just so good.
He plays like fucking Anton Sugar from
Pretty Much. Yeah, he's like the guy you hire... but then he just does everything his way.
See, I got a lot of... he played a character called the Trinity Killer in a season of Dexter.
Right.
Which was... I mean, that show is abysmal.
And that was the best season
yes,
of that
it was.
Show.
It was the best
just because of him.
And one of the best characters in the entire series. But
yeah,
John Lithgow is just a great actor in general.
Right, and he plays this... He played the Trinity Killer exactly like he played this. It's just this cold, calculated... Maniac.
Basically, this character, he basically creates like a sex serial killer who isn't even real.
Just for fun.
Just to, not even for fun, just to like cover up a murder he's eventually going to commit.
Yeah, so he's killing people to, in anticipation of killing somebody that's involved with a governor.
Right, he kills.
Just to cover the tracks.
he's also raping them, which is something the film only hints at, but then later.
It's in a report.
Yeah, it's in a news report, and then John Travolta is listening to the tape of him rape. What's her name at the end? Like you,
Nancy Allen.
Yeah, Nancy
it's
Allen.
Like a way more extended version. I don't know her character's name though.
Sally.
Okay,
Sally Two Shoes.
So
that's not her last name. I made that
it's
up.
An Irish name, I believe.
Lithgow is perfectly creepy in this fucking role,
yes,
and because I didn't watch that Dexter show. I assume that the writers, when they were writing their shitty scripts, just were like, what do we do? And they watch Blowout. They're like, we need that guy.
Pretty much.
You're probably
far
off.
You're probably like 99% right.
Because he's awesome, and I never would have I'd seen this side of John Lithgow.
Oh, I love him as like a creep, because he plays a creep in Dressed to Kill, too.
He's wonderful.
He's really good as a creep.
And once again, we get him dressed like a telephone man with the fucking bell hat on.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So Brian De Palma
loves telephone repairmen, basically.
Undercover telephone guys.
he loves top secret telephone repairmen.
Brian De Palma loves Ma Bell.
Yeah, he loves Bell Atlantic.
The movie ends with John Lithgow staring at a couch for an hour.
You're confused. That was Sisters from last week's podcast.
Right, so basically, also I wanted to say, like, did you guys assume that the people who hired John Lithgow are basically the president, like the actual sitting president, because there are three candidates in that news report.
Yes, and one of them is the current president.
Right, it's like the Mick Ryan, the president, and then some third person who has like 2% of the vote.
No chance.
So
Mick Romney.
Mick Romney. I think it was McRib.
Yes,
candidate McRib.
It's back.
So.
It was Ron Paul. He was only like 45 at that time.
Oh, all right.
So, like, I would say based on that, we're meant to assume that the people who hire John Lithgow are the people who work for the president, which is kind of like really subversive.
But then they're like, "We didn't hire you to kill him.
Right.
You're crazy." He's like,
basically, they hired
crank caller, wrong number, and he hangs up.
They hired basically John Lithgow to make an accident so that Mick Ryan would be caught in a car with a woman, and it would just ruin his campaign. But John Lithgow, because he's a psychopath, says, like, well, that's not what I wanted to do. And he basically shoots at the tire because he wanted to kill Mick Ryan. And he has, like, he's like, well, I didn't directly kill him. I mean, it's like psychopath reasoning.
But it's strange because at a certain point they cut him loose. They're like, we want nothing to do with you anymore.
Right.
And he still keeps going for fun.
Yeah.
And that's why I do see that No Country for Old Men connection.
Yeah.
Where basically, he's not really working for anyone. He just has like a principle that he wants to get this job done.
That is, yeah. And then Woody Harrelson shit gets in the way and he has to kill him.
I don't know if you watch the same film.
Dave, are you delusional?
All right, well, we're going to take a slight break here and come back with the shocking conclusion to Blowout.
We're not even halfway through the movie.
I think we're about halfway through, but I don't think we're halfway through talking about this.
No, not at all.
This is a really good movie. And if you haven't watched it yet, watch it. And then...
Yeah, watch it during this break.
Yeah. You got 2 minutes.
We're going to take a 2-hour break.
Here at Cutprint Film, we do our very best to keep you in tune with the movie industry. We're revolutionizing the way you read movie reviews by putting them on the internet. Go to cutprintfilm.com and we will guarantee you a pleasant experience. We're breaking new ground every day to bring you the finest material possible. We've partnered with such clients as morelikeradio.com, antifanboy.com, and Joystick Jerks, the podcast. So check out all of that and more on cutprintfilm.com. And remember, have a Cutprint Film day.
trying to vibe out.
You're crazy for this one, Rick.
What does that even mean?
That's
talking to Rick Rubin.
Yeah, he's talking to Rick Rubin.
Hey everybody, you're listening to the Cut Print Film Podcast.
You're listening to the Jay-Z podcast. All Jay-Z, all the time.
This isn't even in Jay-Z. I don't understand.
We just took some nice brown stuff.
Yeah. I'm feeling it. I had a brownie.
This is the scene where Travolta's driving down the highway and his tire blows out in Pulp Fiction.
Dave, I think you're delusional again.
What is going on?
Dave just makes up his own movies.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Madhouse. I'm your head nutcase in charge. No. Scooter.
So if you're just joining us now, which seems impossible because this is a podcast, not a real radio show.
If you don't know how to work your phone.
Yeah, if you somehow turn on this podcast and then slid the slider to the middle of the show, you're a lunatic.
Please, please unsubscribe.
We're talking about Brian De Palma's Blowout.
1981.
All right, so I'm going to finish the rest of the synopsis of the film, and then we're going to go back and talk.
Yeah, we're going to get back on track here with some serious film talk.
We're going to basically talk about how every scene in this movie is worth talking about.
Yeah.
All right, so.
Testify, Chris.
After Jack Terry saves the girl from the car, this is what happens. Jack and the girl from the car, Sally, played by Nancy Allen, team up when it becomes clear that the car...
Don't read it, say it.
I gotta... What the fuck?
Just kidding.
He's directing you in this scene.
Punch the keys!
You sound like Nancy Allen in this movie.
Becomes clear that the car accident was no accident. Jack tries desperately to put the pieces together with the audio recording of the accident, only to be laughed at off as a conspiracy nut. Closing in on Jack and Sally is Burke, played by John Lithgow, a mysterious figure working for shady higher-ups, trying to silence Jack by any means possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of my synopsis that I
basically
culled from Wikipedia
in my own memory.
That's about it. That's the synopsis.
It culminates in the scene at 30th Street Station where the crazy guy, Lithgow, has pretended to be the editor of a newspaper and has lured Sally in. But Jack, being an ace sound guy, has wired her.
Yes, he's wired her for sound.
Which ties back to something earlier in the film, which we'll get to.
So the whole time... this is happening. Travolta's following close behind.
Listening in.
And it sets up these awesome moments where it's like a sound detective almost. He's trying to find them. She'll be like...
expertly filmed.
Very cool.
Basically, like the last half hour of this film is one of the best just sequences of scenes in a film I've ever seen.
It's exciting. It's perfect. And it makes you wonder, how did this guy give us Snake Eyes? And the Black Dahlia.
Yeah, because I don't know what happened to Brian De Palma, but this movie, he's firing on all cylinders. There's this incredible... it's not even a chase scene. It's just John Travolta driving to get to Nancy Allen.
He drives right through fucking City Hall.
Well, first he drives through a parade.
This is my favorite scene in the whole movie.
I don't even know how they pulled this off and filmed this without killing someone.
Oh my God! Did they just have the camera on a dolly and they were moving it? Because there are people nearly being murdered.
It literally looks like there was a real parade going on and Brian De Palma just said action and John Travolta drove through this parade.
And people are diving out of the way literally at the last minute.
It looks so real.
It's incredible.
It's fantastic. John Travolta, he drives through a parade. He drives through... the Philadelphia City Hall has this big archway that basically runs under the building.
Right.
And if you're not from around here... we've all wanted to drive through it a million times because it's, for some reason, in the middle of our city where all the traffic funnels towards this building that you then have to drive around.
Yeah, instead of having a normal intersection, there's this building in the middle and you have to drive in a square around it.
Right, you're always like, God, I want to get to fucking Butcher and Singer, God damn it. How can I get there? I got to go around all this... And the Philadelphia City Hall is this old, gothic, gorgeous building.
Mm-hmm.
I went there to get my marriage license, actually, because I got married in Pennsylvania.
Me too.
And on the way out, I actually saw the mayor just outside the building, and I said, it's the mayor! That's my Philadelphia City Hall story.
Unlike you riveting Bolsheviks, I got married in New Jersey.
So, John Travolta, he drives basically under City Hall, through this archway. You can't do that now, because they're like...
That's an overhead shot.
There are concrete partitions there. they probably put up after someone saw a blowout and they said, let's put those up. So
let's blow it out.
So no one does this.
It's real. It's wonderful. Look, and it's just incredible that he was able to film it like this.
Right.
Because like Dave just said, yes, that is another overhead shot. How?
A helicopter, yeah. I guess.
And then it all culminates at Penn's Landing.
Wait, I have a tiddly bit about that.
That's not a thing.
One of our patented tiddly bits.
I have a tiddly wink.
It's like our version of pop-up video.
Oh, all right. Well, that's the show that hasn't been on the air in 20 years.
So, this scene...
A tiddly bit.
This scene particularly revolves around Travolta not only trying to stop Lithgow from murdering his hooker girlfriend, I guess.
Hooker friend.
Yeah.
They're friends with benefits.
Friend with benefit. Friend with bennies.
But he's also trying to stop him from stealing his film because he has the only film footage. Yeah,
he's got the only copy of... Travolta, earlier in the film, was able to pair his sound recording of the accident with these photos that a photographer took at the same time, and he made it into a
flip book.
He took
35 per second somehow. Yeah. But anyhow, so he's trying to stop him from stealing that film, right?
Yep.
While driving through a parade down Market Street,
right. Yes.
This footage, the actual film, was stolen.
Wow. I heard this.
And they had to reshoot that scene. So it's like
awesome. Insanely
meta.
That's awesome.
I wish I knew who out there had that footage.
And I want that footage.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even out them. I'd be like, hey, can I come over and just watch it?
The original blowout parade footage.
It just seems so bizarre that the scene where he's trying to stop someone from stealing his film gets stolen, and then they have to film. You guys were talking about how intricate this must have been and how many... I mean,
so we had to do it twice.
Yeah, they had to set up all those. They had to get the mummers back in there.
Oh, I had that written down.
To mum.
I have never been happier to watch mummers get run over because at the Liberty Jubilee Parade, I hate the mummers.
Yeah.
And they're just strutting around like fucking assholes. Yeah. They're just strutting assholes.
No disrespect to my late father who loved the mummers.
My whole family loves the mummers.
But I was never a mummers fan.
Nope.
But every New Year's Day, my dad would be like, we gotta go see the mummers. And I'd be like, no thanks.
But dad, there's adults throwing up on the street.
Look, I like Tasty Cakes. I don't like the mummers. It's a give and take.
Yeah,
here.
It's 50-50.
Okay, so it culminates with Sally getting raped and murdered in Penn's Landing.
While these fireworks are going,
yes, she's murdered. You heard that correct.
This is the most gorgeous murder ever, because, oh my God, just like, basically...
It's a slow-motion Steadicam shot.
Even before that, there's this scene where she's screaming for Travolta, and she's framed in front of this giant American flat, and it's... Just that scene just takes my breath away the way it's filmed. And it's
it's a
gorgeous.
Nice commentary on the state of America in the 80s.
It's tragic.
Yeah. It's just
even though I hated Nancy Allen's performance, I still felt horrible that girl
and I think
was
that's,
being murdered.
I think that ties back to what I said earlier that like she's so childlike and babyish that when she actually gets murdered, it makes it 10 times more devastating. Because if she was like this hard, like, mean hooker character, I'm not saying her murder wouldn't be sad, but it would have less
would
of
think
an
it would have been deserved a little more.
Not even that, it would just have less of an impact. And the fact that she's so like innocent, like
nothing.
She's even though in this film she's basically like a hooker, she's innocent. She's like this innocent character.
She's naive.
Yeah, and she gets strangled and stabbed and raped to death, and it's like, God, that's terrible.
Nothing really hits harder than the final scene, which is
Travolta. So, wait a second. Before we get to that, I just have to say, I've written in my notes here that when Travolta is running to save Sally, the camera
pushes
slows
everyone
down.
In the way.
Well, he's running for approximately two eternities. It takes him forever.
It's brutal. It's a brutal scene.
It bothered me. Like, why? Is it so slow in getting him? I know that she has to be murdered. I get that. But did they have to show him just like every single step of the way?
Yeah, it was a bit tedious.
Keep in mind, before the scene, he crashed into Macy's.
Right. During the daytime, and now it's nighttime.
Well,
he's been out for a while.
Yeah, he was in a hospital and he woke up. Not a hospital, he was in an ambulance. Yeah. And
isn't going to jail for any of this.
Yeah. He crashes into a Macy's, which has a display of. What the fuck's that guy's name? Patrick Henry, the guy getting hung. Give me liberty or give me death.
Yeah, that bothered me. You just see this dummy hanging in the background with a tri-corner hat.
It's either I think it's Macy's now, but back then it was Wanamaker's, which isn't around anymore.
Mm-hmm. But that, I mean, that's a smart thing De Palma does, because there's multiple people get hung in this movie. So it's like,
oh, no,
there's kind of a parallel there.
But I'm just saying, like, the dummy hanging bothered me. It was effective.
Back then, you could have displays at your store of people hanging. You can't do that anymore.
Okay, so we come back to Travolta has been recording this the whole time. So he sits around listening to it like a creep. And then the final scene is Travolta in the editing room we saw him in originally, right, with the
watching
opening
the
scene.
Exact same scene they were watching, like, in the opening of the film.
Everything comes full circle.
But with the scream of
Nancy
Sally dying.
Yes.
Really dying.
Her
dubbed
death
over.
Screams dubbed into that original scream. And the which, film, in case you forget, it sounded like this.
Mine was close. Anyway, it is devastating.
And the film does this actually, this sneaky thing, which I don't know if you guys picked up on, but in the opening, before the credits come out, there's like a heartbeat sound, and then you hear Nancy Allen scream from the end of the movie.
No,
and
I did not pick up on that. That's fantastic.
That's actually in the beginning of the movie. There's like a heartbeat sound, and there's like someone breathing heavily, and then you hear Nancy Allen scream from the end of the movie, and then the titles slam together and they say blowout. And
that is wonderful.
That's the scream you hear of her being killed, basically.
And then it kind of pulls back a little and just shows Travolta, like,
he's just devastated.
He's just utterly,
he's like
beaten.
Sweating, and he just lights a cigarette. He just looks horrible.
And that brought back to mind the ethics, the question of ethics that showed up in the beginning of
the
film.
He's given up on it.
Yes, he's
completely.
He just has no ethics. He doesn't care. I mean, he feels guilty, but that's just how
it is.
It's
his job now.
And the director is like, that's a great scream. And he's like, yeah, it's a great. And then the director plays it again, and Travolta covers his ears, and he just looks horrible. And then the movie ends. And it's like, ugh.
I believe it goes into some more of that saxophone, noir
that
music.
Sexy music.
And this is obviously De Palma saying how filmmaking ruins your life. There's a little bit of De Palma in that Travolta at the end covering his ears.
And what hits so hard
to the criticism.
One of the things that makes, like, Nancy Allen being killed while wired so devastating is earlier in the film, Nancy Allen and Travolta's character, they're at like a bar and they're talking about how Travolta got into sound editing.
Yeah.
And Travolta says he used to
wire cops.
Yeah, he used to work for the police and he was trying to bust crooked cops. And there's this lengthy flashback scene where
he worked for Internal Affairs.
Yeah, say.
He puts a wire on a cop and the cop is trying to record other cops saying, you know,
Dirty cops. He's trying to catch dirty cops.
Right. And the
give him a shower.
Unfortunately,
I think you misunderstood.
Unfortunately, the cop recording them, he's so nervous, he's sweating, and it makes the recording device on him just burn him.
Yeah, like the battery starts bleeding.
Yeah, the battery acid burns him. And so,
and Travolta's like, those idiots with their battery, they didn't even think about him sweating. And it's like, you fucking tape the thing to him.
Are you not the sound expert?
So, as a result, the crooked cops, they find out they're being recorded, and they hang this cop recording them. And so it's like a double whammy. Like, Travolta was basically
by the wire, by the recording.
He's hung by the wire in a bathroom. So it's like a double whammy, because the first time Travolta wired someone, he got that person killed. The second time he wired someone, he got that person ended up getting killed.
And I really didn't see it coming. I thought this was going to be his retribution.
Yeah, like he's going to improve on his past mistakes.
Here it is, guys. Travolta gets people killed with his wire. Yeah. What does John Lithgow kill people with?
His wire watch.
Oh, he kills them with season 3 of The Wire. He beats them to death with
he kills them with a piano wire.
Yes, in
that
his
comes
watch.
Out of his watch, fucking 007 style.
John Travolta, John Lithgow has this badass Strangler's watch.
I believe it's a Fossil watch.
Yeah.
Fossil brand.
So there's a parallel between John Travolta and John Lithgow in this movie. Both their names are John.
That's right.
And both of them are great dancers.
Okay, can I come back to the opening scene?
Yeah, right. Sure.
Now we're going to take it back. We're going to talk about
this movie.
We're going to moonwalk all the way back
to the
beginning.
We're going to do a whole another 49 minutes on this. That's me moonwalking.
That's pretty
terrible.
we have disagreeing.
Those two different thoughts at the same time.
So Brian De Palma does these wacky things with his movie openings, right? Mm-hmm. As we've seen with Sisters and this.
Right. Yes.
And he was questioned about this in 19, whatever year this is, 81.
Right.
Which is a year after another film comes out, which he seems to be.
I think several films came out in 1980.
Yeah.
Only one film
came out. I have a quote here. I have a quote here.
Hollywood was on strike that year.
De Palma saying about this very thing, the opening scene is a blank slate. The audience is ready for anything. To waste that time with some boring geography shot mystifies me.
Yeah. On the Criterion DVD, there's an interview. Noah Baumbach interviewing De Palma, and De Palma's basically he's talking about how he just hates establishing shots.
Oh, I was gonna say there are none in this movie.
Yeah, but
and it's great because he's like, why, exactly like you said, like why would you waste time just showing like, oh, here's a building, like who cares?
But he's
this isn't a sitcom.
Yeah,
he's directing this comment at a specific movie.
What movie is it? Tell us, Dave.
To waste that time with some boring geography shot, the opening scene. He's talking about The Shining, a movie that came out the year before.
You think so?
Yes.
Really?
Because not only that, he's using... I think The Shining overshadows this movie because they're both thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
And they both come out within a few months of each other. And we'd never hear about Blowout.
No, you don't. When Chris suggested watching Blowout as the second movie, I was like, okay, sure, I'll watch it. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I was reading, there's an essay that comes with the Criterion DVD, and I was actually shocked to learn that the majority of critics didn't like this movie, and also it pretty much bombed. Like, Pauline Kael loved it because she was a big Brian De Palma fan. Like, she loved Brian De Palma's movies, but I was actually surprised to hear that this movie didn't do well when it came out because it's so good.
It's excellent.
It's fantastic.
And going back to your Shining comment, I think this is just as good as The Shining.
I wouldn't say that because
No. I love The Shining. It's one of my absolute favorite top five movies. So maybe not just as good, but it's in the arena.
This
it's
does similar arena. Things.
I would agree with that. This
is a wonderful
they
movie.
They do similar things stylizing as well. You talked about the Steadicam POV.
Right.
Garrett Brown, the inventor, the Steadicam operator, right. came off of The Shining and filmed this movie. So he was talking about how he was so excited to do the opening scene because it was a POV shot. And right. Stanley Kubrick would not let him do a POV shot in The Shining. He begged him. He was saying, yeah. I was watching a video of him last
that's
night.
That's cool. Yeah.
And Stanley Kubrick was like, no, those are for cheesy horror movies. We're doing a real horror movie. And then De Palma was like, we're doing a POV shot. And then
I liked that he was doing a cheesy horror movie.
Well, that's the thing.
That's awesome.
Garrett Brown was like, I can finally do a good one. And when he got there, De Palma was like, no, we want to make it look as cheesy as possible. And he said he was so disappointed because he had like it all planned out in his head how he was going to make it like the best horror POV shot. And he had to make it look like exactly like the Halloween shot,
yeah,
which is what this is based on.
It's exactly like Halloween.
I thought that was interesting. There's also some other parallels where both characters are, Jack Torrance and Jack Terry, they have very similar names.
Yeah.
There's the female characters equally as annoying in both movies.
I didn't even pick up on that.
Yeah.
That's an excellent observation.
These are,
'cause I hate Shelley Duvall's performance in The Shining. And you guys defended it. Well, at least you did.
I defend it because
I
love that movie.
I think
so
it's
much.
Actually a great performance.
Oh. I just,
she's
and
she's,
listen to me.
She's
I'm not a
suitably
woman,
terrified.
I'm not a woman hater. Okay, please do not get that impression.
Jeff, take off that no ma'am shirt from Married with Children.
There's even like that scene in the hotel with the wallpaper, how it's stylized in the same way Kubrick uses the carpet as a symbol. And I actually want to write something comparing these two films.
I think this film is almost as good as The Shining. That's I'm gonna. Tailor my
this,
original opinion.
I would. I honestly agree. The direction in this movie is phenomenal. Just like
which
I can't remember the last.
To say again, what happened?
I don't know.
This guy was an expert.
Maybe like a mule kicked Brian De Palma in the head.
He's lame.
Yeah, I just don't know what happened because...
I'm going to tag on to something Chris said earlier, maybe before we recorded, but of the De Palma films I've seen, this is the best. This film's a masterpiece.
I think this is... I would call this a masterpiece, and I would call this De Palma's best film.
Agreed. Masterpiece. The best De Palma film I've seen. I'm not going to... I haven't seen all his films.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Passion.
Oh.
While we have...
No one has.
Well, what... Do you think this is the best, or you...
This is the best De Palma film
I thought you were
going to
say
seen.
Snake Eyes.
While we have our pants off, I'm going to say that this may be the most underrated movie of the 20th century. I can't think of another movie that is not...
I don't know if it's the most, but it's definitely underrated.
Well,
I think now it's gotten respect. I mean, it's a Criterion release. So.
And that's what kind of brought it some attention.
Right.
But I will say that I think it's one of the best movies I've ever seen that doesn't get any attention.
That's what I'm saying. Publicly. It's underrated.
It's almost like ridiculous how good this movie is. Like, I had seen it before, but I rewatched it for the show, and I was like... It kind of like blew my mind because like I was like, I can't believe how fucking good this movie is.
It's excellent. And John Travolta, hey, what happened again?
Yeah.
What happened to Johnny Travolta's best movie?
So hands down. We can agree on that, right?
Let's talk about...
Did you see Look Who's Talking Now with the dogs? The dogs talk, Dave.
Did you see Basic? I'm shaking my head at the microphone.
No one did.
So let's talk about what we loved about this movie besides the things we...
I saw Basic. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just a guy who's always late to everything. That's
why
you carry
very, very close to the mic.
So, yeah, Travolta is fantastic in this movie. In that interview...
They drown him in that shit.
Just, like, his body language in this movie is so... Just, it's fluid and it's great. And in that interview with Noah Baumbach, they talk about that. And De Palma is saying, like, Travolta is so good at, like, physical acting because he's a dancer. And De Palma is saying, like, back in, like, the 30s, like...
What's Kevin Bacon's excuse, then?
Back in, like, the olden days, the glory days of Hollywood, like, actors were trained to be, like, a million different things. Like, James Cagney was, like, a dancer, and, like, it's Travolta is just so good at just movement. It's, like, even when he's just, like, pointing that microphone, it's just, like, it's so...
He's also of the school of... musicals and stage performances, so he's used to using full body in his performances.
Just like
that's where Nancy
subtle like things like in this movie, just like literally just pointing a microphone, it just looks cool the way he does it. And it's like if you try to do that, you just look like an idiot. You're like
just a dork on a bridge.
Just like I'm pointing a microphone.
You look like Harry Potter.
Yeah, you would look like someone trying to wave a fictional wand, but just
your Patronus.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where my complaints with Nancy Allen come in, because there are scenes where you could see that Travolta's trying to like fluidly move the conversation.
And she's like Frankenstein's
she's just reading,
monster.
Yeah.
But again, I think that ties into her character because she's supposed to be like this stiff.
Oh, what are you trying to do to me? You're trying to drag the conversation on.
That's what I'm talking about. I think Travolta just outshines her now that I'm. Thinking about it a little more, maybe she's not abysmal. maybe
he's just really good.
Like, so good in this performance and so well cast.
It's another fucking Shining parallel where Jack Nicholson is so good in that role that he makes Shelley Duvall.
You're never going to get me to say positive things about Shelley Duvall's performance in that.
I don't know.
Popeye, on the other hand, a lovely olive oil.
She was born to play that role. But I would say this is like Travolta's best performance, which is kind of depressing because he's had such a...
Well, he's great in Pulp Fiction. But
yeah, he is, but I think this is better.
This is
better
his best
this.
Showcase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he carries this film.
Yep.
All right. Oh, God. There's this... We were having an issue early in the podcast, this episode, because we're trying to go through the movie, through the synopsis of the film, but there's so many good scenes and there's so many things De Palma does in this movie... The scene where Travolta realizes that Lithgow has erased all his tape and it starts to carousel and go around the room.
It's just this circular dolly shot, basically, where just... Yeah.
It's as if the camera's in the middle of a room on a turntable because he's listening to all these recordings.
Nothing.
And Travolta keeps like running out of the room and running to a bookshelf, but it's all perfectly timed where the camera... comes around.
And again, that's like, it ties back to
it almost makes you feel dizzy. Like it creates a feeling like the way Travolta must be feeling.
And that's a Hitchcock
as he realizes his tapes are all, his livelihood has been destroyed because all of his tapes have been erased.
And it's also recalls like the last scene of the conversation where Gene Hackman basically rips up his entire apartment. And the last shot
looking for bugs.
Yeah, and he's like just sitting in his apartment playing the saxophone, and like there's just a ruin of his apartment around him, and that's sort of what happens to Travolta. He just destroys his lab trying to find like a tape that works.
Because then towards the end of the movie, there is a shot of Travolta's, you know, recording room, and it's just all like torn apart.
Yeah. And he's like just
broken.
He's mindlessly cutting together the audio.
He's been erased.
Speaking of saxophone.
That's my
of all the films to reference in this episode.
Speaking of saxophone, what did you guys think of the music in this? Well, that's not an answer. You just made noise.
That's my sax.
It was a little obtrusive.
You're playing Christmas Rapping by the Waitresses, if I'm not mistaken. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Well, here's one thing I'll say.
Coming out this year.
That we touched on this in the beginning, how the sound is jarring at first.
Yeah.
And it's because Travolta's a bad sound guy in this film.
Well, he's definitely not good at wiring people.
He's a bad sound guy, and we're following this conspiracy nut. Like, you could see why no one believes him.
Right.
Because he's not really that good at his job. And
well, yeah, you even hear the director of the film say, I've heard this before. You're using the same wind, you bum.
And that opening... And
he also keeps blowing off his job to chase this conspiracy. There are several scenes where the director is like, where the fuck is that audio I want? And Travolta's like, I'm busy.
He's like, we need a cast.
He goes to work precisely two times in the film. Yeah. The opening scene and the end scene.
Yeah. And it's like, he's not good. That opening scene is cut... It is canonically edited by Travolta.
Yeah.
And it's horrible.
Yeah.
Sound wise.
That's a good observation. That's you're getting bombarded with this garbage sound, and I just realized that. Yeah, that's his doing.
The movie
that's
just
his handiwork.
When you start the movie, you feel like, what's happening? Did I just turn the wrong movie on?
Yeah, I was gonna call one of you and say, I don't think we should do this movie. This blew up my TV.
Do you guys have anything else?
Well, back to the music. We never actually said what we thought about the music.
Yes, we do have something else. The point I brought up.
I can't fucking remember the music.
Oh, it was a lot of saxophone, a lot of 70s, or not 70s, a lot of detective noir type.
I would say
music.
Almost through the whole movie, I found the music a little like distracting, but like not the final scene, but like the climax of the film where Travolta finds Nancy Allen murdered and he's hugging her, and again, there's a Dolly, the Michael Bay shot, if you will, where fireworks are going off above Travolta's head, which is gorgeous. I think the music perfectly works, and it's almost like the music has been building to this scene where it's appropriately melodramatic and upsetting.
I really enjoy the music. I also really enjoyed the music in Sisters, and I looked online, and a lot of people found both movies to have obnoxious music.
Right.
But this score was done by Pino Danaggio.
Yes, that's his name.
Who did the music for, did the score for Don't Look Now with Donald Sutherland, which I hate that movie. But he's done a lot of De Palma films, Carrie, Body Double, Raising Kane, Passion.
Do you want to hear something kind of nuts?
Kane. We're going to do a callback to a earlier movie recommendation from earlier this year. He did the score for Tourist Trap.
Holy shit, I should have picked up on that. Tourist Trap has a goofy soundtrack, so it fits.
This score just worked for me. I thought it was a lot of fun. There's a lot of sax going on.
It's it's appropriate for the era.
Well,
like if it were in a movie set in this era, it'd be like,
why don't you fuck off with this?
Yeah, you'd be like, what is happening?
You're in luck, Jeff, because as of yesterday, the Blowout soundtrack is back in print.
Oh, on vinyl,
They announced yesterday that they're going to be re-releasing it on vinyl.
Listen, I didn't say I liked it that much, did I?
I don't want to spend money on a damn thing.
But that's insane. Yesterday, of all days, to be re-releasing the fucking Blowout soundtrack.
How topical.
We're the best.
Oh, yes.
Let's pat ourselves on the back some more, boys.
Okay, but De Palma has issues, and his issues are dialogue. He lumps too much exposition you were saying he doesn't do establishing shots, but he does establishing dialogue, which is the worst. We got to go in this room because we're going to get him. It's a lot of stuff like that.
I didn't get that at all, honestly.
I can see what you're saying. I didn't have a problem with it.
No,
Chris, but I think that maybe that's just a sign of the times.
Like, if I had to choose,
only 1981.
I'm saying it's a De Palma thing because he says here, he was asked, why is the thriller so perfectly matched to cinema? And De Palma's answer was, because you could tell a story in pictures. You don't have to rely on character and dialogue. It's fascinating. I'm fascinated by silent movies. It's amazing to me that few directors want to do that anymore. He's not invested in the dialogue or the character, which is something that is...
Yeah, it's a problem since he wrote this movie.
It's a problem, but I would also say, like, the majority of the dialogue in this movie is just natural. It doesn't sound like movie dialogue, which I appreciate, because
Dennis Franz's dialogue is a bit insane.
All right, well, Dennis Franz plays sort of like a stereotypical generic private detective in a wife beater shirt.
Hey, does this guy not own a single shirt without slop on it? What is going on?
Hey, you went into the drink. What am I supposed to say? He's on TV.
I got pudding stains all over the front of my wife beater.
Pudding. What about the G?
He's on TV referring to the presidential candidate going into the drink.
Yes, to his doom.
But a part of me
at the drink.
Part of me wishes people actually just still talked like that, because I would love that.
I thought about that too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have not much more, but I would say, what do you think? My closing question was, why do you think this is so underrated? My answer was that it mimics a lot of films like. I would say this is the Philadelphia version of Taxi Driver in a way, like the way it showcases New York.
I wouldn't say bleak, because it is bleak, but not, I don't know, it's a kind of a different.
There's a different tone to it, yeah, for sure.
But
the main character is less crazy.
I would say this was overshadowed. Raging Bull came out the same year, The Shining the year before.
I would say I think the reason when this came out it just wasn't well received is because it doesn't really fit one genre. It's like, it's a political thriller because there's a presidential candidate, but it's not really interested in politics.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
It's, you know, it's a thriller in general.
Which I loved because I hate political films.
What
especially,
a slog.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, I think for me, the thing that makes this movie so unique is a lot of De Palma's films, especially like the earlier ones, they're from the beginning to the end. Even when they deal with serious topics, they're sort of all tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Like Body Double. I love Body Double, and I love Dress to Kill. But those movies, they sort of wink at the audience. It's like him. It's like, I know what I'm doing, and I know you're in on it. I would say this movie, after that, it starts off that way with the opening. It starts off winking at the audience, but as the film progresses, it's so invested in itself. It's like a serious.
It takes itself seriously.
Yeah, it takes what it's trying to tell seriously. And that ending is so bleak, and it's De Palma saying, like, I'm not like laughing anymore.
It's perfectly bleak. Like, right. I love endings like that. Where,
so do I.
I mean, we touched
it
on that.
It shocked me. This was a shocking ending.
And like, I can imagine like an audience seeing that, knowing De Palma's earlier films, being like, what the what is this ending where this character is completely ruined and his love interest is murdered? Like,
remember my dream ending for Edge of Tomorrow? I got it with this film. Like, I love a bleak ending where it's
I do too.
Yeah.
And this ending really worked for me. It was excellent. But
because that's how life ends, bleakly. Yeah.
We all get killed by John Lithgow in the end.
We all die alone, raped by John Lithgow.
We all die at the Liberty Festival.
But 1981, there were a lot of like big movies released. Raiders of the Lost Ark was released that year.
Oh, Christ.
American Werewolf in London was released that year. Chariots of Fire.
The Boogans.
All right, so, yeah, The Boogans.
The Boogans was not released that year, but Stripes was, so it's same thing.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was a good year for good movies, so I guess it just got overshadowed. I don't know.
Yeah. But my dinner with Andre.
And
anybody?
My dinner with Andre the Giant.
He just kept saying fee-fi-fo-fum.
Come on, both. This is a masterpiece.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's a wonderful movie.
I didn't think it would be. I read.
Neither did I.
I read that this is Travolta's best, and I'm like, I'm going to hate this the same way I hated Sisters. But, and it's, I loved having seen Sisters before this because you, like Chris was saying before, you see the progression.
Yeah, it, like Sisters sets up. Because like, just like Sisters, how Charles Durning was like the private eye character, Dennis Franz is like the private eye character in this, but he actually has something to do other than hang out on a telephone pole.
Forever.
Yeah. Staring at couches.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I'm on a lot of limbs tonight.
Yeah.
Get off that limb, Dave. It's dangerous.
Like an ape man.
I'm going to go on record and say that De Palma is probably a peeping Tom. Because he is obsessed with this fucking trope.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think voyeurism is just a big thing in almost
filmmaking.
And just all of his movies. He loves voyeurism.
I'll be honest. I'm excited for next week.
He scrolls down to the V on UJizz.
I don't understand.
He's looking for voyeurism.
What the f?
I'm pulling the ejection seat on
right,
this one.
It's right after vor.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm excited for next week, Casualties of War.
Okay, yeah, can I set up Casualties of War?
Please do. This is Dave's pick.
Yeah, I picked Casualties of War because I think the signature... A good director, you can always tell by how they handle a war film. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say every good director has his war film, except for Paul Thomas Anderson. He does not have a war film yet.
I would say a lot of good directors don't have their war films, so I don't agree with that.
Jon Favreau hasn't made a war film.
Christopher Nolan does not have a war film.
Well, he needs to get on it, because I would love to see how Christopher Nolan handled a war movie.
I would,
did
too.
Did you say war film or wharf film?
Yeah, wharf from Star Space Nine.
Did you say war film or dwarf film?
Oh, Steven Dorff?
No, Dorff, the character who's on his knees and pretending he's a midget, and he goes golfing.
Are you talking about McDorfus from the motion picture Hot Dog the Movie?
Malick has the thin red line. Spielberg
Dave,
has...
Dave, we're not done talking about McDorfus.
Kubrick has multiple war films. Let's see what De Palma brings to the table. Casualties of War.
I'm very excited about watching it now that we've seen what he can do when he's, like you said, firing on all cylinders.
This is another movie. I've seen Casualties of War, but I haven't seen it in a long time. Longer than I haven't than Blowout. Blowout, I think I watched like 2 years ago. I haven't seen Casualties of War since like high school.
Casualties of War also takes place, or is filmed... doesn't take place takes place during Vietnam, but it's filmed 7 years after Blowout. So Sisters brought us 7 years to Blowout, and Blowout's going to take us seven more years into the future to Casualties of War.
Okay.
And so
I like it.
So watch it.
All right, so did anybody else see any movies this week?
Oh, I saw Sin City 2, A Dame to Kill For.
How was it?
It sucked.
Is that a sequel to the first Sin City?
Yeah, it is. And that's all I have to say. It sucked.
That's about it for that one.
Read my review on cutprintfilm.com.
Maybe we should recommend some movies.
Let's do that.
Right. It's time for the cutprint film. We do them every week on the show. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm so glad you played that one.
That will never get old to me.
the befuddled.
That is my favorite one.
It's I love them all. Yeah,
they're like my children. I can't pick one.
Yeah, you can't do Sophie's Choice on that. That's absurd. All right, who wants to go first? I went last week.
Dave, you go first. Excuse me. Please, Dave, you never go first. You go first.
Okay. I'll go first.
Please do.
Sounds good.
Who's going to go first?
We're doing this gag? Yeah. This stinks.
Wah.
It's like an Abbott and Costello routine.
Oh.
Who's on first?
Anyway.
Shall we go through the whole thing?
Please don't mock Abbott and Costello, because I love Abbott and Costello.
Leave.
It's so harsh. This has gone off the rails quick.
My goodness.
Okay. I'm recommending Ruby Sparks.
Not a documentary, Dave?
No. This is a movie I watched this week after having seen What If, starring Ruby Sparks star Zoe Kazan.
Who is adorable.
Yeah. It was a dismal failure of a movie. But then I watched Ruby Sparks, which is a movie she wrote. I don't know if you guys know that.
I actually did not know she wrote that.
Yes, not either. I was very impressed when I found that out.
Good for her.
And isn't she like, she's the daughter of Ilya Kazan? Is that, or like the granddaughter? I think she's related to
him. Yeah, something like that.
I'll look it up while you talk.
Ruby Sparks is about a writer who writes his girlfriend to life from the pages of his typewriter. And while that sounds like the most
It's been done a million
cheesy.
Times.
It's handled very well. Paul Dano plays the writer, and Paul Dano's amazing. Yeah. We all know that.
Love him.
This is also directed by the team that directed Little Miss Sunshine, which was a
good movie.
Very good movie. Yep.
Oh, I hate Little Miss Sunshine, by the way. I'll be the one guy who says that.
Was that your O?
Yeah. Oh, I don't like that movie. Anyway, go on.
The cool thing about this movie is that it's kind of a commentary on romantic comedies and works as a critique of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Right.
Kind of suggesting that in order for this person to be real, you would have to write them from nothingness, and then when you actually had them, they would annoy the shit out of you. That's the theme of this movie. And it's pretty dark in tone.
Really?
I wasn't expecting that. And it's very good. Zoe Kazan and Paul Dano give amazing performances. Paul Dano plays a total fucking creep. He's a megalomaniac.
He's excellent at that.
I don't think he can play anything else but a total fucking creep.
Vulcan.
He's a Vulcan.
He's a total Vulcan creep.
Yeah, it's very good. It's kind of, and it has like a Pinocchio Frankenstein's monster theme to it.
See, I don't know. I was hesitant to see it just because like that plot, it rubbed me the wrong way. Like it sounded too much like Stranger Than Fiction, which is a movie I actually really like, and it just bothered me. I was like, oh, they're just doing Stranger Than Fiction. But
it's definitely a little darker than Stranger Than Fiction, but it's still light. Like it's not too heavy.
Okay.
Chris Messina, you know who that is? He was on Newsroom He's in the Mindy Project.
Okay.
He plays her boyfriend. He's a good actor, and I like him in this because he usually plays a bad guy, and he plays Paul Dano's brother in this, and he's a good anchor character for the film, like for you, like to be like, if this was my brother who had just written his girlfriend, it puts you in that role kind of. I don't know what role it puts females in. Maybe they feel like they've just been written into the film while they're watching.
That seems like a healthy thing.
Yeah. <that's
laughs> But it's cool because he can make tweaks of her, and it runs into all these ethical issues and
But can he make twerks of her?
Mm. He could type.
I think it was written before the twerk became mainstream.
Was this pre-twerk?
Yeah, this was pre-twerk.
Pre-Turk. Pre-Turkish invasion.
Pre-Turducken. They weren't yet stuffing turkeys into ducks into chickens.
Those were the good old days.
Mm-mm, I love me a good turducken.
Anyhow.
Was that the sign of the end of Dave's segment?
We had to end Ruby Spark.
Oh, by the way, my wife cannot stand when I say the term Manic Pixie Dream Girl. It makes her cringe.
Well, it's not like you made it up.
I know.
You're not Nathan Rabin.
I tried explaining that it's an actual intellectual
term. He's Nathan Rabin, right? let me hit this.
Thanks.
I was wondering why you pulled that scream.
That was why,
but
I figured, you know what, this is too good to use just three times. I got to use it 17 times. I'm going to go.
Please do.
My pick is the 1976 film The Pink Panther Strikes Again.
Wow.
Starring Peter Sellers and Herbert Lom. This is the fifth entry in the Pink Panther series.
What a film to pick.
But I love it. It's so funny. It's just nonsense humor. It's directed by the same director that did all the Pink Panther movies from the first
one
on. No, incorrect. Blake Edwards is this gentleman's name. And it stars Peter Sellers as he's now Chief Inspector Jacques Clouseau, because the former Chief Inspector, Charles Dreyfus, has gone insane because of Clouseau's antics. There's a wonderful scene in the opening of the film where Clouseau goes to visit his former boss in the Nut House and proceeds to drive him even further insane. There's also a wonderful scene in the middle of the film where Clouseau is in a knight's outfit for some reason, and he hits somebody directly in the face with a mace. He goes to shake their hand, but there's a mace attached to his arm, and he hits them right in the face with it. It's wonderful.
I've seen several Pink Panther movies, and I always like blur them together. Is this the one where he goes to like a nudist colony? Is that this one?
No.
Okay. That's the one I remember the most for some reason.
There's also a famous sight gag in this one.
Yeah. That's the reason.
For some reason, Clouseau has purchased a new disguise that he wants to try out. It's a Quasimodo outfit. that it's got the ugly teeth.
Sneak into the bataleur.
Yeah, he's got like the ugly teeth, and it's an overcoat that he wears, and there's a balloon in it that fills up with helium, and he floats outside his window of his apartment into the city streets. It's fantastic.
All right, now I want to watch this.
It's so silly, and I watched this growing up, and my whole family used to watch it and just howl laughing.
Do you need to be well-versed in the Pink Panther lore before seeing this?
0%.
All right, then.
You can just put it on because it spells everything out for you.
Not only that, those Pink Panther movies are timeless.
They're like Three Stooges.
Yeah, they're British Three Stooges, I would say.
Yeah.
Because those are British, right?
Well, Jacques Clouseau is French, of course.
Yeah. God, Dave, can't you tell that's a real French accent?
Yeah, it's most of the cast is British.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is the Pink Panther diamond is not in this film at all. I don't even know why.
Basically, they just sort of just kept the name after like the third movie because they're like, whatever.
But it's so silly. It's like such a funny movie.
In the first Pink Panther movie, the
well, doesn't Leonardo DiCaprio get it at one point?
I think you're mistaken.
Oh, that's Blood Diamond. Never mind.
In the first Pink Panther movie, Clouseau isn't even the main character.
Nope.
It's David Niven, I think is his name. He's the main character in that. So, and everyone was like, well, this character sucks. We care more about Clouseau. Mm-hmm. And he became... And then they remade it a bunch of times
with
Steve Martin.
Steve Martin driving a stake. He's driving a stake through the heart of comedy.
Yeah.
So yeah, Pink Panther Strikes Again.
All right, where did you? Is it on Netflix or? Do you have the VHS?
I have it.
Do you have the Betamax?
I don't know where you can watch this. To be honest with you,
I'm gonna
seek it out though because it's awesome.
I'll have to go to Hollywood Video and stand in the rubble. Because it doesn't exist anymore.
Look, people, if you want to watch a movie, type the name of the movie and then type streaming, and you'll figure it out.
Or there's a site that's isitstreaming.com, and you can find out what service you can purchase to stream.
We don't want to go to jail.
This is putting us to sleep.
There's a Foley artist in the studio.
Now is a sprinkler. My pick. Thanks. My pick is the 2012 film Chronicle.
Ooh.
All right, this film is directed by Josh Trank, who's actually directing the new Fantastic Four film. Mm-hmm. So this is a found footage movie, but unlike most found footage movies, it's not a found footage horror film. It's a found footage superhero film.
It's a lost and found footage.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I found it at the lost and found. So basically this movie is about three friends. They go to a party, and then there's basically this strange event that happens.
Is this Palo Alto?
No.
No, none of it is.
And so the strange event basically turns them into superheroes.
Oh, I remember this.
So, like, they can fly. They have super strength. And I don't know. I was not expecting much from this movie, but it's so good. It's shockingly good. Basically, Dane DeHaan, who's trying to think of his name. He's in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and he's terrible. But in this movie, he's excellent. He's also
has green face disease.
Yeah, he has the green face disease. He's also in what the fuck's it called?
Place Beyond the Pines.
Yes,
he plays the younger.
He plays Ryan Gosling's son in Place Beyond the Pines, and he's so good in this. Basically, most superhero movies, people get superpowers and they start doing good. In this movie, it asks, what if you were like a mentally unstable person and you got superpowers, and that's what this movie is. And it's like Dane DeHaan's character, he has like this abusive stepfather and he just has this terrible life, and he just gets superpowers one day. And imagine what this like emotionally disturbed character would be like if he could just do these amazing things. And that's what this movie is about.
Doesn't he kind of destroy the whole world?
Not the whole world, but there's like this huge action-packed climax of the film, and the film was made for very little money, and just the amount of like carnage and wreckage Josh Trank is able to pull off with his low budget is just so impressive that it makes me want to see this Fantastic Four movie he's making, even though I normally would be like, I don't give a shit. But like the fact that he's directing it makes me interested in the movie.
There's some good actors in that too.
Michael
Jordan.
I wouldn't say.
Yeah. No, I'm serious. Michael B. Jordan from The Wire.
Yeah, not Michael Jordan from Space Jam.
Yeah.
Kate Mara's in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Michael B. Jordan is actually in Chronicle.
Oh, he is.
Yeah,
he's
one of the kids who gets superpowers.
Awesome. He's an excellent actor.
He's like
Kronos, the god of time.
He's He's like the one kid in the group who's got like charisma, and he's like he's actually what you would picture a superhero to be. Whereas Dane DeHaan is like, no, this kid should not have superpowers.
The guy who played Koba is Dr. Doom, too.
From
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
And,
so it has a pretty promising... I'm not going to say I'm excited for Fantastic
and
Four.
And Zoe Barnes, ace train face reporter, is the Invisible Woman.
Yeah, I'm not actually...
Catch a train with your face.
Yeah.
I'm not excited for it, but it's at least something to... look forward to about the film.
Yeah, I would, you know, I'll give it a chance. Normally I would not give this a chance, but the fact that Josh Trank is directing it.
This time next year when you guys are like, who's going to see Fantastic Four? I'll be like, okay, I'll see.
So,
2012's Chronicle.
Nice.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's that time again.
I hope you've stuck with us through this whole 4-hour episode.
Well.
Yeah, it's been fun, ladies and gentlemen.
It has, but as all good things come to an end...
So does this show.
We must bathe one another with sponges.
I don't know. It's the ritual we perform.
I started talking, but didn't have a way to get out of that sentence.
That's how I talk every sentence in my life.
Next week, as we said, we're going to be talking about De Palma's Casualties of War.
And that'll wrap up our De Palma series, and we're going to follow that up with David Cronenberg, will be our next director.
Awesome.
If you're feeling lonely, just go listen to some of our old podcasts that you never heard before.
Like episode one, which I've deleted.
Yeah, you'll never find it. It's the lost episode, because it's bad. It's the pilot. It's the pilot, if you will.
We recorded it in the trunk of a vehicle.
Or why don't you smoke a smokeless cigarette?
Yeah, smoke one of those e-cigarettes. Yeah.
From antifanboy.com.
Yes, they sell e-cigarettes there, and they do a podcast
about e-cigarettes.
About comic books and video games and e-cigarettes.
Yeah.
Also, who else should you check out,
guys? You should check out Joystick Jerks, and the joystick they use is made from an e-cigarette.
It's a single e-cigarette with buttons on it.
Dave, do you have anyone to plug?
Go to stamps.com for all your...
Stamps.com!
Dave's been listening to too many podcasts.
Yeah. Right. We're the only podcast not sponsored by stamps.com.
We gotta get on that.
Or audible.com.
Listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Yeah, that's all I've been doing. All
I have a feeling he'll never plug us.
Never. We're too... we use salty language. Yeah. Also, morelikeradio.com, that is a website on the internet.
Yeah, you could go to their website and view their never-ending slider.
Yes. Also, cutprintfilm.com, that's us, everybody.
Please go there. Also, go to iTunes and give us a review. Not one star like that clod.
That hammerhead that gave us one star.
I mean, I think we're at least worth two. Two stars. Come on.
And if you're cruising down the highway right now...
This I hope
one
you
goes
run
out
into
to you.
A ditch. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody.
Roll your top down, let your hair out, and run into a ditch. Oh, are we not doing the ditch one?
We're done with the ditch.
Right. Just think to yourself, it's only 7 more days.
Till Christmas.
Till another cup per
show. Oh, wow. I didn't know where we were.
When will it be Christmas? I got my scarf.
Chris, it's only fucking August. Calm down.
August? That's not a month.